You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Merry Christmas, Bill.
Merry Christmas. Christmas Eve Eve.
Yes. Taping
on Thursday. Is your family in the Christmas spirit?
It is. We're taping at night, which is weird for us. We normally tape in the morning. It's evening. I've been out day drinking with my family in D.C. today,
and
now I'm back. We went to the art museum, Smithsonian, and then we had lunch in Georgetown.
So you're going into the heart of the COVID surge when you could be safe in, isolated panhandle of West Virginia.
And speaking of which, man, I'm wearing, I don't know if you could tell, people see the Christmas, the Santa hat. I'm wearing, proudly wearing my West Virginia shirt. And this is a shot was it Joy Behar or Bette Midler?
Bette Midler.
One of them. They're kind of interchangeable, but whoever.
There's a bit, bit of a talent gap between Bette Midler and Joy Behar.
You are the wind beneath my wing, Bill Scher. Whichever the case may be, took a shot at West Virginia. And I would just say Mountaineers will always be free. Almost heaven.
She apologized, Matt. She apologized.
Wild and wonderful. So I'm wearing the shirt in protest with the Santa hat. But no, the masking thing is coming back in D.C. They were pretty strict about masks today. I was actually, we had lunch at Fiola Marais, which I don't know if you remember, but Biden got in a little trouble for not wearing a mask inside that restaurant maybe a month or so ago. So as it happens, I was there for lunch today. It was quite nice.
Now, when you go to D.C., do you lord your real America, West Virginia-ness all over everybody?
Oh, all the time. And, if waiters are not prompt, I may just be a country lawyer, but where I'm from, I lay it on thick, very thick, Bill.
What's a West Virginia accent?
Actually, I don't know. I mean, we live in just barely in West Virginia, and I certainly wouldn't try to do a West Virginia impersonation. I think Joe Manchin is probably about real West Virginia. Wouldn't you say? I think he's probably in the sweet spot.
He certainly wants to communicate that, but I don't feel like he's got that much of an accent. It's like you hear Joe Manchin, you're like, oh, that's West Virginia.
Yeah, well, I don't think there is a stereotypical West Virginia accent other than that. So I do want to get to Manchin, Bill, but before we do, had a glass of wine. we lost Joan Didion. Did you see this?
I did see this. I gotta say, I'm as much of a history nerd as I like to make myself appear. I've never been a great reader. I don't read a lot. I don't read a lot of fiction. I don't read a lot of literary essays. So I never got into Didion, but I imagine that already like puts you, three notches below a high intellectual caliber for a lot of people, but that's just the plain fact. I'm not an expert on Didion.
Well, I'm not an expert either, and I really didn't read much of her fiction, but she's got some nonfiction that's really approachable, and a couple of books that were collections of her essays. One is called Slouching Toward Bethlehem, and one is called The White Album. And you can easily get those, and they are very approachable. And yeah, I just think she was one of the greats. And it's just one more kick in the teeth as 2021 goes out the door. But I would recommend those two collections of essays for anyone who wants to write or be a better writer. Reading those books will make you a better writer.
So. You mentioned Ted Cruz, right?
Yes. It may have been in our exhaustive pre-interview.
Yeah, I'm exhausted. We got a puppy yesterday. we got a puppy, so it's like having a baby, and did not get a lot of sleep last night. So forgive me if I'm incoherent. But you want to second? Do you want to second the mansion? You want to second the cruise?
We're supposed to tape at 8 a.m. this morning,
and I slept through that.
And it was a rough night because of the puppy. So yeah. Here we are. I would have been on coffee. I would have been bright eyed and bushy tailed and virtually sober on coffee if we had done 8 o'clock. But here I am. Anyway, yeah, Ted Cruz, who I guess he was at the Turning Points America. What's it called? Turning Points USA, TPU, whatever.
It's like Charlie Kirk. It's like CPAC Jr.
Yes, the Charlie Kirk group. And he did an interview with some young journalist there and said, like, hey, I'm next in line. I should be the next Republican nominee, right?
Well, what I find fascinating about it, and just so you know, for the third year in a row, I've written a piece for Politico sizing up how well the year has gone for potential 2024 candidates. I did this in 2019 for 2024. I've done three of these pieces for 2024. So thank you to Politico for making this a tradition. And so I did get into Cruz a little bit for that piece. I wrote it before he made the comment. And his comment was, it's not verbatim. It's very common for the runner-up of the previous primary to end up being the nominee. Hillary Clinton was the runner-up in 2008, became nominee in 2016. Mitt Romney was runner-up in 2008, became nominee in 2012. So it's not like that's never true. But
I think in the Republican Party, it's what's the Democrats fall in love, Republicans mm-hmm. fall in line. But still,
how many runner-ups have you had? You Trump wasn't a runner-up. George W. Bush wasn't a runner-up.
So Reagan runs against Ford in 76. Right, so
Reagan was a runner-up. McCain was a runner-up for 2008 after being a runner-up in 2000.
Bush was the runner-up in 80, becomes the nominee in 88.
Right, but VP.
Dole was the runner-up in 88, becomes the nominee in 96, right?
Right, okay. But George W. Bush was not.
Anyway, so, yeah.
Bush was not, and Trump was not. So to Cruz's point, okay, you have a good amount of examples there, but you wouldn't say it's a ironclad rule, and I think you have to factor in what other existing data that we have. I mean, you know, Bob Dole was the runner-up in 88, but was also Senate majority leader. He had a continuing leadership perch. You know, George H.W. Bush, runner-up, then VP. John McCain, McCain served made more of a Cruz-like example where he didn't have a leadership post, but he was a fairly prominent figure and got on TV a lot and was in the public eye a fair amount.
McCain was, I was just thinking about this today for some bizarre reason. Don Imus had endorsed Bill Bradley and John McCain.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they used to be a big deal just going on the Imus show. And John McCain was funny. He was also just ubiquitous. So yeah.
So it's not like it can't happen. But Ted Cruz, you look back at Ted Cruz's 2021. What did Ted Cruz do to put himself in the position of being the presumptive leader of the party? The most famous thing Ted Cruz did was go to Cancun in 2021. he is someone who has high name ID for Republican. And you look at polling right now, he polls. If you include Trump in any poll, Trump wins going away. But if you take Trump out of it, the top two people are DeSantis and Mike Pence. If you put in Trump Jr., he'd be two or three, and then Cruz is three or four. Again, depending if Trump Jr. is in there or not. and it's generally in single digits. This is a guy, he was runner up. He should be better. He should have a higher number. If he had any kind of stature, bond, love, respect in the Republican Party, he would at least be in double digits consistently, and he's not. So yeah. He should be saying to himself, why aren't I the likely nominee? Why aren't I competing better against Mike Pence and Ron DeSantis? Maybe it's because I would be a terrible candidate because nobody likes me. I mean, this is someone who has done it, tried it. We've seen how well he can do, and he has been definitively rejected time and time again.
All right, I think that's harsh. I think that's harsh and wrong. I agree. I find Cruz annoying and off-putting, but I'm clearly not in touch with the Republican base. Okay. But let me just say,
I think here you are, Matt. I mean, I think Cruz is disliked across the ideological spectrum.
I don't think that's the key problem. I would say, look, if you have to go tell people it's your turn, and that you're next in line, like that's like telling people you're funny. You don't tell people you're funny, you know? And so Cruz, this is the kind of thing that if someone's trying to talk Cruz into running, let's say Jeff Rowe, that strategist guy, Jeff Rowe is trying to talk Cruz into running or trying to talk a donor into supporting Cruz. He says, look, the Republican Party always supports the next guy in line. They're going to do it again, right? That's a behind the scenes thing. That is not what you make your selling point or your rationale for running. Your rationale for running, you know, why do you want to be president? Well, because I'm the next in line. You know, it's like that is not a compelling reason.
Even on top of that, there is a good chance that this field is going to include a former president and or a former vice president. And you're going to argue you're next in line because you came in because you won the Iowa caucus in 2016 and a handful of other states after that. I mean, how much more do you win besides Wisconsin? I don't remember how many states you won. I mean, there's no argument that he's next in line.
Okay, I mean, here's where I think the key is. Trump changed the whole world, certainly the Republican Party, and so like if Trump was a normal politician, which he's not, he would have gone away. And then in a normal world with normal politicians, Ted Cruz would be next in line. But we have the whole paradigm has shifted. The idea that we're even going to elect a politician president is not a gimme, man. It could be The Rock. It could be Seb Gorka or Tucker Carlson. Like, you know, like it would be a stretch for Cruz under your premise. It would be a stretch for Cruz to say he's next in line. I'm saying like it's even worse than he thinks, right? Because we don't even know what the future is going to look like. You know, the next candidate could be a professional wrestler or something.
So runner up in 2012, I should remind you, was Rick Santorum. Was Rick Santorum next in line after that? Of course not.
I think he may have made the case at some point that he was.
And he got completely steamrolled by Donald Trump in 2016. I mean, just because there are some people who lose respectably. Like that was a solid first try. You came close, buddy. You know, let's sand off the rough edges and give it to you the next time. Like that was not Rick Santorum. And that is not Ted Cruz. Okay. Like so I'm sorry to be redundant, but to your point is that the game has changed in the Republican Party, which I don't disagree with. But I sort of agree that if the game hadn't changed, Ted Cruz would be right there. Like he did not run a good enough 2016 campaign to justify to have anyone believe he would think he was, you know, just this far away from it.
I think Cruz ran a good campaign. I don't think Cruz is a good candidate, but I think he ran a very good campaign. And I think that had he lost to a normal politician, let's say Rand Paul, I don't know, that Cruz actually might be next in line. But Trump changed everything. And not just the fact that Trump won, but the fact that Trump became president and did crazy stuff for 4 years. And Ted Cruz was okay with most of that. I do want to put a pin in that quickly. I'm intrigued by Rick Santorum. This is a guy.
Third time's a charm.
Stick with me here. So first of all, I think Rick Santorum gave the best speech, for what it's worth, of anybody at the 2012 Republican convention. I don't know if you remember it. It was a speech about hands. You know, I shook hands with the coal miner. I held the hand of, you know, an old man who, whatever. It's very poetic. It was like Peggy Noonan could have written this thing. It was like the only poetic at a convention that was about you didn't build this. It was the only poetry, and it was a very good speech. I'm not doing it justice. But Rick Santorum was a populist. He wanted to give favorable, you know, tax benefits for factories in America. But this is way before Trump. You know, he was basically a populist who wanted to bring back manufacturing to America. And it would have been, I would just be interested to see what Santorum could have been if he had been a little less personally annoying.
Well, that's the whole point.
Like, and maybe tone.
Like Santorum, you know, had the rough outlines of what a candidate of the kind of candidate that would do well in a Republican primary in a changed party. But he was a terrible person to be that candidate because he's just not a very likable person. Much, and I'd say Ted Cruz is even less likable than Rick Santorum.
There is something about them, isn't there?
I mean, you know, it's hard to really put into words like what constitutes likable in a Republican primary, in a modern Republican primary when Donald Trump is the person that gets chosen. But you know, but Trump had flair.
He does. Trump has a certain charm.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. He is a very strong personality to say it in an understated way, in a way that, you know, Cruz and Santorum just aren't, you know. And, you know, DeSantis, I mean, the person who had the best 2021 of any non-Trump Republican was DeSantis. Because DeSantis found a way to be Trump-like without being, you know, pale imitation. You know, DeSantis has his own character. He picked his own fights. I mean, he had the advantage of being a governor that he could pick his own fights. And he was able to pick fights. I mean, you know, there are arguably three litmus tests in the modern Republican Party. One is, where do you stand on election fraud in 2020? Where do you stand on COVID measures, and where do you stand on abortion? And DeSantis,
so I'm like a 50%, I guess.
Yeah.
Based
on. DeSantis is someone who really made his mark in the COVID fight. And he had the means to not just say things about it, but actually do things about it. To say, I am not going to have a vaccine mandate in Florida, but I'm going to ban localities from doing vaccine mandates. He even tried to make it so businesses could not have their own vaccine mandate. I mean, that's how far he tried to. I mean, so they actually passed in Florida that, you know, restricted the ability for businesses to do their own vaccine mandates, but it was short of a total ban. So because he, big state, purple state, and could, you know, push those buttons, he really made a name for himself. Now, what complicates things for DeSantis, which is two things that are complicated for DeSantis. One is he made his mark, but not in a way that makes him distinct from Trump. He didn't lay down a predicate to run against Trump because he's still very much a Trump acolyte. So I think it's hard for him to justify a candidacy if Trump's in there, though he might try. He pointedly refused to rule out running against Trump. And Trump has been grousing about that privately. And that's leaked into the media. The second thing is, I think abortion is going to be tough for DeSantis. DeSantis has to run for re-election in 2022. And he's a favorite, but he's not like, but he's not a lock. His numbers in Florida are okay. Polls against the Democrats running against them, you know, he has the lead, but it's not like a giant lead. And this is a state that is not hard right socially. And it has laws on the books that protect abortion rights. Like the status quo in certain states, if Roe goes, when Roe could go down in June or July, I mean, it'll probably at minimum get greatly rolled back, giving states a lot of leeway to pass their own restrictions. And there are certain states where they got laws on the books that kick in right away. They don't have to pass something new. Abortion will be banned or severely restricted automatically. That's not Florida. Florida has liberal abortion laws on the books. And so there's that pressure for a Republican. What are you going to do? What are you going to support to fix this? All the pro-lifers in Florida are going to say, hey, DeSantis, what's up? And he has been reluctant to embrace the Texas law because, I mean, the Texas law is not all that popular in Texas. According to, you can argue, I know, Matt, you've argued to me that it's not getting people animated. Maybe it's not, but just polling-wise, it's not a popular law. So DeSantis might be reluctant to go as far as Texas right before his own reelection, because that might be used against him in his reelection campaign. So he's got a couple of problems if he wants to run against Trump. But I do think he was able to, just by basic polling in 2024, he leads in polls where Trump is not in the race. You cannot say that for Ted Cruz, let alone Rick Santorum.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. I think even if Trump goes away, there was a shift. He constituted a shift. And so the linear progression of like the next in line thing is out the window. Like, I think DeSantis is definitely much more likely to inherit the mantle than Ted Cruz. But we'll see what happens. But I'm not bullish on Ted Cruz in the near future, personally.
And now
I think all the candidates who ran against him in 2016, I don't think any of them will ever be president. What do you think?
In 2016, yeah, I think. Well, look, Chris Christie, Rubio. I mean, those two might run again. I think they would be weak candidates. I don't think they did themselves well in 2021. Christie had a book that was a bomb. Rubio did get a bill passed. He got a bill passed, bipartisan bill to ban Chinese imports made with forced Uyghur labor.
Is this the one that just passed?
Just passed.
Biden like signed it today, right?
I think that's correct. I mean, I knew it passed both houses of Congress. I don't know when he got signed. But when has foreign policy been the determining factor in a primary when outside of, you know, wartime? So, yeah. Kudos to Rubio for like sticking. I mean, he's trying to be the China guy in the Senate. And, you know, kudos to him for getting a bill passed. I just don't think that's nearly enough to make your mark in a presidential primary. Now, Mike Pence, you know, a lot of Pence haters out there, and I'm not saying he's on anything like a glide path, but the one thing you could say for Mike Pence in 2021 is he distinguished himself as his own person separate from Trump. You know, it's awkward for him if he has to run against Trump. He doesn't get the same VP advantage that most VPs or former VPs get, because they're usually seen as de facto leaders of the party. They get an automatic base of support from loyalists, party loyalists. You've been the public eye for 48 years. Pence doesn't automatically get all of that because Trump either runs against him or actively dumps all over him for not being a loyalist during the Electoral College count. But by owning that, saying very clearly, look, we're not going to see eye to eye on that day. You know, I did what I had to do to uphold the Constitution and the law. I think there was some fraud out there, but that was not my place to put my thumb on the scale. He at least has laid down a predicate why he can or should run, even if Trump is in the race.
Bill, he's one of Matt's people. He's one of Bart's people. He's one of my...
And he pulls okay.
Do you remember that? Do you remember that Simpsons episode?
Which one of Bart's people?
But he's one of my... I did my list. It's coming out, good Lord willing, on Christmas Eve. My heroes of 2021. Mm-hmm. Mike Pence made the list this year, Bill.
I mean, Pence pulls pretty well, relatively speaking. You know, the top three in polling are Trump, DeSantis, Pence. And when Trump, there's not a whole lot of polls that take out Trump and Trump Jr. But the most recent one that did that, it was DeSantis 30, Pence 25. And they would represent, distinct strains of the party. I talked about, before 2016, that even though there was a huge appetite for a woman candidate, you had two people in Biden and Bernie who were high name ID candidates, former VP, runner up in 2016, who represented distinct ideological strains of the party. And though it was going to be hard for a candidate to break into that, and that proved to be true. I don't know if DeSantis or Pence are quite the same stature as Bernie and Biden did, but I do think they have some stature, they have some base of support, and they represent distinct schools of thought in the Republican Party.
I would actually like to see that. I think it would be interesting to see a DeSantis versus Pence primary where the Trump stay out of it. I think that would be, I don't know, Packers versus Buccaneers. I don't know. It would just be a good matchup. It'd be fun to watch. And it would also be fun because whoever wins, I don't think the Republic would be at stake. Like, I don't think either of them. I probably vote for Pence, because he did demonstrate some character on January 6th. But either one, they're not going to be as bad as Trump. So I hope that we get that, Bill.
Well, let me shift gears, because the other big news since we last talked was Joe Manchin's nuclear bomb on Build Back Better, delivered on Fox News Sunday, the most annoying of platforms for Democrats to have to hear that news is, of course, on Fox News.
I don't think we can underestimate the fact that it was done on Fox, like that is part of what created the anger.
So I wrote a piece about this at the Washington Monthly that went up earlier this week, because I got a lot of people on my Twitter feed saying, are you going to apologize to the squad? The squad got it right, you got it wrong. They should not have separated Build Back Better from the infrastructure bill because you needed that leverage over Manchin because he clearly wasn't really a supporter. And, I'm someone who said that trust was warranted, that Manchin could shape this bill to his liking, and therefore he would support it. I mean, it might change from what the House passed, probably would change, but would support it. So in my piece, I said, well, look, if you want to argue that AOC and the squad read Manchin better than me, okay. It certainly looks like he has genuine antipathy for large segments of this bill. But if you're
let me just stop real quick. Manchin never said he was going to vote for this.
Correct.
So like, it's not like when we say, do you trust him? Like, Manchin never said, if you vote for the bipartisan bill, I will vote, for BBB.
Correct.
Like, there's no trusting him. He never promised to do that, right? I mean,
no, but Biden. I'm saying trust in a different. Implied. I'm not arguing that Manchin betrayed people's trust, but I would argue that it was an act of trust to pass the infrastructure bill and believe that Manchin would find a way to get to yes.
It was an act of faith.
Yeah. And Manchin has to be aware that if he does, actually refuse to pass any version of this, that he's hurting Biden. He's hurting the Democrats' chances in 2022. He's hurting moderates in the House who voted for Build Back Better, who they were reluctant to vote for anything that wasn't pre-conference because they didn't want to be on the hook for something that wasn't going to become law, have to defend controversial elements of a bill that isn't even happening. Why did you vote for this when Joe Manchin is against it? You know, why didn't you have the same concerns that he had? So it's not that Manchin is going back on his word by doing this, but I do think it is harmful to the nascent trust that had been nurtured by progressives and moderates in the passage of the infrastructure bill. But anyway, my point is, if you had that deep suspicion of Manchin, if you thought this guy is fundamentally a Republican, he doesn't want to do this stuff, he doesn't want to do climate, he doesn't want to do child tax credit, he doesn't want to spend money, then that should have informed Democratic thinking in January. It shouldn't just have informed, I mean, if he's that much against it, like holding back infrastructure didn't do squat. I mean, that's not even like a hypothetical. It did not do squat between the taking of the bill hostage in the summer of 2021 through the fall. You saw what it did to Manchin. Nothing. He was like, I don't care. I'm just not going to pass this thing. In fact, I want to keep chopping and chopping it down. And even when Biden chops down, I'm still not going to commit to voting for it. So the linkage strategy was not nearly sufficient a strategic conclusion to draw. You should have been talking to Joe Manchin in January and February, and he was raising red flags in February. He said in early February, before the rescue plan was passed, saying, I don't like what Biden's doing here. I don't like the reconciliation path. We should be finding bipartisan common ground. So he's already squeamish, you know, but the conclusion people drew was, well, he came around, he voted for it. So you know, this is just Manchin posturing. And he'll be there for you at the end of the day. Instead of sitting down with Manchin and saying, hey, I hear you have some problems with what we're doing. Tell me what you want us to do. Tell me how far you're willing to go. I got this idea for reconciliation, but it's going to do A, B, C, D, E, F, G. Do you think you can do some or all or some of that? And if you're getting bad vibes from Manchin then maybe you don't do as much. Maybe you don't try to do as much. And then the expectations are more aligned. So that's where I think, you know, expectations got misaligned because Manchin was not looped into that process. The strategy was, we're going to do what we want to do and then try to bring Manchin around. And if he's going to, you know, make us cut it down, fine. We'll bring him in at the end of the process. And he should have been brought in at the start of the process to ensure he was going to be there at the end of the day.
So my whole take is the BBB was always a non sequitur. We're going to just spend trillions of dollars on human infrastructure. Why? There's just because progressives want to do it. There's really no, you know, problems with inflation. We're already just piling up debt and deficit. I don't think this hurt. In fact, I think you could argue Manchin saved Democrats. They should have just killed this to begin with. And they should be taking credit for passing infrastructure. They passed a bipartisan infrastructure bill. That should be a big deal. Instead of focusing on the negative, what they didn't get, they should be celebrating this huge accomplishment, which we never hear that much about anymore. The last thing I'll say, Bill, it seems to me that there is a pattern that, you know, I've been documenting this now since about February. As you'll recall, Republicans who had just supported like a $900 billion COVID relief package, went 10 of them went to the White House and they met with Joe Biden. They had this great meeting with Biden. And then he comes out and Jen Psaki puts out a release saying, we're going to do this by, you know, that was nice. It was a great meeting, but we're going to pass what we want to pass via reconciliation. Okay. But Republicans don't get completely sour. They actually keep working with him. And they decide to do this bipartisan infrastructure bill, and they are on stage with them. And Biden says, oh, by the way, let me just mention, we're not going to pass this unless we also pass at the same time in tandem, unless I can also sign, you know, this human infrastructure bill which later became Build Back Better, stunned Republicans. And there seems to be a pattern of, in meetings, Biden is this amiable, affable, folksy negotiator, and then progressives and or his staff change things. And it seems like when I was reading the Washington Post reporting on what happened with Joe Manchin and what precipitated his going on Fox News and pulling the plug on BBB, it seems like Manchin was having a good time, a good relationship with Joe Biden, that Manchin had gone to the White House and met with Biden and proposed, you know, something smaller, a smaller amount of money for BBB. Biden was okay with it. They were going to negotiate and talk in the new year. And then the White House put out some sort of a statement saying it was done. But you tell me, am I being unfair here?
Well, I let me go back to something you said earlier, though, that I think is unfair. I don't think this. I don't think Build Back Better is concocted out of thin air. I don't think this is an out of left field bill. I don't think this is just progressive wish lists for the heck of it. I mean, this is trying to address real problems that Democrats have talked about for a long time and want to be able to do what they can to make the country better when they have the votes to do so. It is, as I talked about in a past show, they don't address the immediate problems that we're facing. They don't address the pandemic. They don't address inflation directly. But, you know, kids do need, we do need universal preschool. You know, preschool is a good that we want. Democrats want more people to have. The climate is a real problem.
Do we need universal preschool?
Putting aside the ideological dispute on that, there is certainly an argument that preschool is good, that children who have quality preschool do better in life, and Democrats believe that and want to see more kids get it. The climate is a real problem. The plan is in real jeopardy. We want to do things to avoid a climate crisis while we have the numbers to do so. I mean, so these are real things, not made up things. Now, having said that, you know, I would have approached, if I was Joe Biden, I would have approached the year differently from the get-go. I would have tried to get the 60 on the rescue plan. I think there was a way to have gotten something that, you know, that wasn't 1.9 trillion, but maybe around the 1 trillion marker. That I think probably would have been sufficient, economically speaking, and would have set a bipartisan tone for the year. So the expectation going forward would be, what else can we get with 60? And I think infrastructure would have fallen into place more easily from that point. And I think you could have pursued certain things. There are some openings
that would have been more. To me, that would have been more in keeping with his mandate.
Yes, I agree with that. So
the BBB stuff, when I say it was a non sequitur, it just didn't seem like that's, you know, I paid fairly close attention to Biden's, you know, wrote about Biden's race for president. And I'm sure if I dug into it, into his policy papers, he probably did have a statement on all these things and said, but it just, I felt like what he was selling is what you were just describing, though.
Yeah, I mean, I think what I just said is how he ran. And I think he had opportunities to fulfill that early. I mean, and at the time with the rescue plan, people would say, oh, this is Lucy in the football. It's not a serious offer. We're in a crisis. It's not a time to get jerked around. It's not a time to do a small bill. It's going to be insufficient to the task. Don't these guys water it down and make you look like a bunch of chumps. And this is all informed by how people on the left felt about Obama and the Recovery Act in 2009. But in hindsight, and I grant that there was a certain logic to it based on what was known at the time. But in hindsight, considering that, A, inflation became a problem, I can't tell you exactly how much that is because of how big the rescue plan was, but it seems you can't totally divorce the two. Two, the Republicans did show up for the infrastructure bill when they didn't have to. I mean, the Republicans were the margin of victory in the Senate and the House. They were the margin of victory in the House, even when Build Back Better was hanging out there, even when there was still talk about linking the two. Manchin hadn't come in to fully separate the two at that point. which suggests that, hey, there's enough Republicans out there that don't want to pull away the football when they see it's in their interest. I'm not saying that Republicans are just a bunch of, you know, warm-hearted people that want to do the right thing all the time. You have to create the political incentives to do so. They had political incentive to do infrastructure. I think there's political incentive to do a more modest rescue plan. It was still the pandemic. They didn't want to seem like the people who were the Grinches in a time of crisis. And so considering they did the rescue, the infrastructure bill, I think it's a better argument to make that they would have done the rescue plan too in smaller form. And then I think, I'm not saying I'm optimistic here, but I would have tried to get to 60 on climate, on immigration, on minimum wage, on child tax credit. There are certain people in the Republican caucus that have expressed some interest in those topics. And maybe you wouldn't get there, but I would have pursued that first. If it failed, you would say it failed because of them. Republicans wouldn't let you have these things. And so now, having given it our best shot, we will try to do some of these things in reconciliation. And maybe Manchin would have given you the green light on that. He'd say, you gave it the college try. I tried, you tried, to things that we all want. Now we can do it in a way that the American people understand why we're doing it. That's how I would have handled it. But I think all those issues are real issues. They're not non sequitur issues. I just would have gone about it differently.
How come no one? So what you're just describing is what I think Biden should have done, and but it seems like Bush, Obama, Trump, Biden, we're now on four presidents who didn't do things the way I think they should have done it, the way you would have done it. Why? How come nobody will follow this course?
Well, I think the case of Biden, I mean, I can't know exactly what internal conversations were had. I mean, we know there are a lot of people in the White House who are younger, who were, Warren people, who have internalized the narrative that Obama got hosed by trying too hard to be bipartisan and didn't do the measures as big as bold as they should have been, and that hurt him to some degree.
But Joe Biden's been around for 40 years or more in politics. Why would he listen to some 30-year-old Elizabeth Warren staffer?
Well,
he's the president.
Well, I mean, Ron Klain, chief of staff, might be in that boat too, who's an older person and has been close to Biden. I mean, I think there's certain people in the inner sanctum, like I think Steve Ricchetti, I don't know how to pronounce his last name correctly, who has more of a moderate bent, more of a bipartisan bent. And I don't know, like, what kind of internal debates that it had and who wins which argument, that I don't know. But it certainly seems as if once you're president, you start thinking about, what can I get done now? What can I do with the power that I have now? You don't think it's so much about Senate traditions when you're in that place. And so whoever told him you can get 50 for $1.9 trillion and slip in this child tax credit, which is going to be a game changer, and it's going to be really hard to get rid of once the checks are rolling in and people are really liking it. No one's going to want to be the Grinch that yanks that away around Christmas time in 2021. So get what you can right now with the margins you have, considering you might not have control of Congress by 2023. So get as much, let's just jam it all in when we got the time.
Yeah.
And look.
He might not have control of Congress in 2021 either.
Well, I mean, they should not have done that without knowing, particularly on child tax credit. I mean, you had Manchin and others already being squeamish about the cost of the child tax credit in March. So it's not like it's all of a sudden that's been an issue. Now, granted, some of the other Democrats have come around because it is largely paid for over the 10-year period, but it's not paid for on the front end. And that's where Manchin is getting hung up. Let's also be clear about this. The House Build Back Better extends the child tax credit for 1 year only, one more year. And My read on that is, by doing it for only one more year, you're essentially saying it's not going to be extended for 10 years because you're probably going to lose the House, at least. And the Republicans are not going to extend it. So that's a real one year, not a phony one year. And so you don't have to be so uptight about it. Manchin is still acting as like this is going to be another phony year thing. Of course, by killing it this year, he is just proving his own point that these things are on autopilot. He is already showing these things can't be killed. So here we are. Biden didn't have 50 in hand for an extension, and so he should have thought twice about putting it in as a temporary measure and getting burned with it, which is what's happening, you know, right now.
All right, man. So we're off next week. Yeah. Over the holidays. What else should we talk about before we pour some eggnog?
Is there any remembrances you want to give? Any overarching 2021 thoughts you have that you want to share?
I could do a rendition of my poem "'Twas the Night Before Trump's Mess."
Okay.
If you would like.
I would love to hear it.
You want
to
hear it? Sure. Okay. So I wrote this 5 years ago with my friend Jim Eltringham, my writing partner and friend Jim Eltringham, when I was working at the Daily Caller. And so this is 5 years ago, right as Donald Trump was about to become the president, and it's a poem. Here goes. 'Twas the night before Christmas, and all through this town, the chattering classes and masses were down. For hovering over this season's elation, impending doom, Trump's inauguration. The working class folks who were stuck in a slump punished the beltway with President Trump. Transition forces were out in full swing, cheering the coming of America's new king. Kellyanne Conway was just slowing down from her victory lap as the toast of the town. Corey Lewandowski postponed the swamp drain after learning how lobbying firms make it rain. Steve Bannon was checking his list once and then twice. Those damn never Trumpers would pay a steep price. Erickson, Goldberg, Will, and the lot would all find themselves in a terrible spot. These folks and more made Steve's naughty list, which isn't a good thing since Bannon was pissed. To these Yuletide invites, they couldn't say no. Not a North Pole excursion, a trip to Gitmo. And me? Well, I just sat here at my desk, wondering how things became such a mess. This new situation was beyond the pale, as outlined in my book, Too Dumb to Fail. And if I failed to say it, I'd be remiss. You can still get the ebook in time for Christmas. Should I go on, Bill? Or is that just a teaser?
Up to you. How much longer do you have?
Another 10 or 15 minutes.
That might be too much, though.
Alone at my office on this Christmas Eve, I wondered aloud, oh, when can I leave? Tucker was shopping for brand new bow ties. He says he stopped wearing those things. He lies. And then from the outside, I heard a loud click. Conventional wisdom suggested Saint Nick. But this, my dear reader, is 2016. Where shattered assumptions became the routine. Then what in my Twitter timeline appeared? Mentions from Trump, it was worse than I feared. Suddenly the office's fireplace rumbled, and out from the ash, the new president tumbled. He was dressed in a suit, and his shoes were ornate, and his hat promised to make America great. He looked round the office with a dismissive smirk, and asked, hey, are you that Matt Lewis jerk? You and the rest of the talking head group have treated my campaign supporters like poop. I'm not quite as bad as you paint me to be. Go ask your mom just how much she likes me. So I'm making my rounds on this special night, settling scores and setting you right. And believe me, I didn't start this, but the media is more unfair to me than to any other candidate or president or possibly person in the history of American politics. It's very important, and I could do other things. Just tonight, an old friend came to visit me. A guy I did a lot of business with back in the 80s. A guy I made very rich, hugely rich. I thought he was dead years ago, but he showed up at Trump Tower tonight on Christmas Eve. Came in, no warning. looked like death, kept muttering something about chains he'd forged in life and trying to let me open my house for his three friends. What a deadbeat. Some people can't handle winning. My people love, my supporters, they love winning. But Jake was a loser. All of a sudden, from behind Mr. Trump, out from the chimney came a loud thump. The argument waned. The room turned less tense. From there on the hearth was Vice President Mike Pence. He said, "Please excuse our new president. I don't think his words convey just what he meant. Most politicians, they primp and they preen, obsessed with their image on your TV screen. The media traffics in rank speculation while turning deaf ears to flyover nation. They yell about all the fake news in the ether, then call each Trump voter a silly mouth breather. These people out there, they know it's all broken. They have valid concerns, and those people have spoken. So don't be so quick to poo-poo and dismiss. Open your heart. After all, it's Christmas." I slumped in my chair. Mike Pence was right. The bubble I lived in is ever so tight. Maybe I had been too quick and hasty to dismiss the pro-Trump vote as stupid and pasty. I looked over at Trump and saw that now. His head was hung low in what looked like a bow. Perhaps I'd been wrong about our new president, whose demeanor was sober and, dare say, reverent. Suddenly Trump's head jerked to attention. Turned out he'd been answering some Twitter mention. "Sorry," he said. "You say something, Mike? Bannon just sent out something I like." It was hilarious, so funny. It was a picture of Santa Claus, and the caption said, nice lives matter." Get it? Hilarious. It's going to drive the BLM folks in the media crazy. I had to retweet it. Rachel Maddow's head is going to absolutely explode under that boy haircut she's got. Pence rubbed his eyes and then looked up with a smile. "I think these visits will take quite a while. We'd better get going along on our way. This will probably go on until Valentine's Day." Trump nodded. "You're right, Mike. We've got lots to do. What's next? Weekly Standard? National Review?" Then they left, with Trump still crowing and grinning. "You know, Mike, we're all going to get sick of winning." Then I heard him yell out, even out of sight, "Merry Christmas to all!" And isn't it great that we can take pride in saying that again? I'm not even president yet, and people are already saying Merry Christmas more. There are more lights. It's great. Really great. In fact, it's part of what makes America great is being able to wish people a Merry Christmas. And believe me, this wouldn't have happened if Grinchy Hillary had stolen the election.
Well done, sir. Well done.
Now, gather around, children. Gather around. Every year, by the way, I do this every year under the tree. I gather my children and you know, legitimate and illegitimate. We gather around and I read them a rendition of 'Twas the Night Before Trump's Mess. So tonight I've blessed you in your home with this as well.
And they sit for that? They don't give you a hard time?
Oh, I don't really read it to them every year. I read it today at lunch, and the waiter loved it so much he asked me to send it to him. So
making friends.
What was your favorite part, Bill?
Make me have to choose, Matt.
The poem. There was a lot there, right?
It was consistent all the way through, man. I could not possibly favor one paragraph. One stands over another. You're gonna be home for Christmas?
No. Well, we're leaving. Oh. I'm going out of town.
That's right.
But don't try to rob me. That I'm gonna leave my people here in guns. But no, we're heading out, man. I'm going out west. I'm gonna be in California. In fact, I'm hoping to make it to my pilgrimage back to the Reagan Library.
Just like a liberal going out to California.
If it hadn't been for those damn floods in Santa Barbara, I was trying to get into the ranch too, but I don't think that's gonna happen.
Well, have a good Reagan Christmas then.
I'm Reaganing. How about you, Bill? Are you gonna be traveling?
Nope, we're home. We're gonna host. Got a few family members coming over. I just got my beef roast, my rib roast Christmas.
That's a concern.
But we're going to have a good time. So I'll see you in the new year.
And let's do this, Bill, and we'll raise our glasses here and toast you and yours. I think that next year we should write a new poem that we will unveil on Christmas Eve here in the DMZ.
Okay.
You know, so we have to, and new characters things have changed in 5 years.
That's true. So. Well, I'll think on that. We get a whole year to think on that.
And next year, you can be Santa and I'll be the elf. Next year, we'll change up.
Okay. All right.
You wear the Santa hat.
All right, sir.
All right, everybody. Merry Christmas. Happy New Year. And we'll see you in the new year in the DMZ.
All right. Take care.
See ya. All right.